Now, before we get to Ruth, which was kind of fun for me, Ruth was the first Hebrew anything, really, I translated in seminary. So it was like taking me back to my first real study of the Hebrew Bible. But I want to talk about the inspiration for this series that I've kind of mentioned, but we haven't really discussed a lot, because, you know, there are a lot of women in the Bible and their whose stories are told, but why did we pick the ones that we're talking about for this series? Well, those are the ones that the gospel writer Matthew picks to include in his genealogy. He begins his gospel by sharing this kind of family tree of Jesus. And he starts off by saying, you know, these are the children of Abraham, and Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and so on, all the way to Jesus. And this is important because he's showing, first of all, as he says in at the very beginning, an account of the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. He's connecting Jesus to this promise that God made to Abraham and that God made to David. And so he is showing us how this whole story has been leading us to this one true king. But here's the thing about genealogies and the way, and Matthew's in particular, is they're not always like these perfect historical accounts, okay? So Matthew has to kind of work with it. There are names that he skips, he leaves out. And so when we read the genealogy, we're not just reading history. Matthew is making a couple points based on the names he includes that we're supposed to get. And so the first point that he's making has to do with the number 14. So at the end of the genealogy, he says, so all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations. And from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations. And from the deportation to Babylon to the Messiah, 14 generations. Now, historically, it's not exactly how it was. There were more generations, and we know that because we can look right at the Old Testament and see the genealogies, and they're just names that he skips. So why 14? Why does he emphasize these 14 generations? Well, here's a fun little thing. He starts out, again, connecting Jesus as the son of David. God made this promise that one of David's descendants would be the king forever. And so, when we look at the number 14, there's this thing in Hebrew called gematria, where letters can stand for numbers. And some people look at the Bible and see this everywhere. They, you know, they're just adding up Hebrew letters everywhere, and that can be a little shady. But here, I think we have good reason to think that Matthew is using this. Because if we look at the name David in the Hebrew, it's three Hebrew, what are called radicals or letters, DVD, or Dalet, Vav, Dalet. And Dalet is the fourth letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and Vav is the sixth letter. And so if you add up David's name, 4 plus 6 plus 4, any math accountants out there, I know we have some. I think we can all do this one, though. 14. And so why the 14? 14, 14? Because Matthew is telling us that Jesus is the son of David. Jesus is the true king that God has promised. Jesus is the new David. So through the way he communicates this genealogy, he's making this point that he's going to be making throughout the whole gospel, that Jesus is the one true king, the Messiah, the son of David. Matthew also includes four women in his genealogy, as I've mentioned, from the Old Testament, and he's making a point there too. In fact, he's making two points, really, because just having the women there is a point. And we've been talking about that a little bit for the last couple weeks. He's lifting up these stories of these women in the Old Testament. But there's another point, too. Why these four? Now, Matthew's audience was primarily a Jewish Christian audience. But let's think about this. Who is it who shows up to greet the young Jesus in Matthew? Who does Matthew have greeting the young baby Jesus? Anyone? Ah, tricked you there. Luke has the shepherds greeting the baby Jesus, but Matthew doesn't have shepherds. He has the wise men, Right. Who are, as we've talked about, these foreign astrologers who see the star and they come and they greet the king of the Jews, even though they're not Jewish. And then we have this story in Matthew 8 that we read a little bit earlier, where Jesus says to the centurion who comes to him and asks for his daughter to be healed, and not just that, but he says, you know what, I know that you can not just heal my daughter, you don't even have to be there. You could send healing vibes or whatever. I don't know if they had that word back then, but you can send like healing vibes from way out here, and my servant, I should say, not daughter, servant, will be healed. And he says, I have not found such faith in all of Israel. So there's this Gentile who is this picture of faith, just like the Magi or the wise men. And then in Matthew 28, the gospel ends by Jesus making this command. He says, go, as you go, make disciples of all nations. Right? And so he's emphasizing this Gentile thing. And so who are the women included in the genealogy? Probably all of them are non-Israelite women. As we saw a few weeks ago, Tamar was probably not an Israelite, or definitely was not an Israelite. Rahab certainly wasn't. She lived in Jericho. She was a Canaanite. Next week, we're going to look, maybe Bathsheba wasn't even an Israelite, because she's married to Uriah the Hittite, as we'll see. And Ruth, today, was from Moab. She was a Moabite. So both of these groups, women and Gentiles, Matthew includes in his genealogy. And it's important because neither of these groups of people really had it great in the eyes of the Jews, especially at this time. In fact, there are prayers that go back really around Jesus' time where men, Jewish men in the morning, and they still do, they say, some will say, I thank God that I was not created a woman. I thank God that I was not created a Gentile. And so on. There's other prayers, but it had gotten kind of pretty rigid by this point. That these people were not really on the same plane as being a Jewish man. And so Matthew, as he sets the scene for Jesus' ministry, is reminding these people of these stories. Of these non-Israelite women who come in and display faith and become part of this great story. All right, so let's now jump into our story for the day, Ruth. And it's truly a beautiful story. I would encourage you to read all the way through it if you want this week. And there are a couple of notes here because there are some strange sounding things throughout the story, and we'll go into this a little bit, but a few notes on the back of your 3G plan if you need them. But what happens basically is that Naomi and Elimelech and their two sons are driven from their place in Judah to Moab. And this is often how Israelites interacted with non-Israelites. There was a famine or there was some tragedy that drives them down there, just like Jacob and his sons to Egypt, right? So they end up in Moab, and Naomi, whose name means beautiful or lovely, is happily married, and they go to Moab, and her sons are happily married. But then the story takes a turn towards sadness and sorrow because Elimelech dies, Naomi's husband, and then her two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, die. And this isn't like the story of Tamar where it was like we're told that they were really wicked and so God, no, they just die. It's just tragic and sad. And Naomi is devastated, and she hears that there's no more famine in her homeland, and so she says, I'm just going home. There's nothing more for me here. And she says goodbye to her daughters-in-law and says, go back to your families. And this isn't like a rejection. This is just like, I have nothing for you. And for your sake, for your well-being, go back to your families. That's your best hope now. And so Orpah, they both protest at first, but Orpah does. Her one daughter-in-law does. And there's nothing wrong with that. The story doesn't like say Orpah is bad. She just does what's reasonable and goes home and lives with her family. But Ruth clings to Naomi. And this is just fascinating because, again, looking back at that Tamar story, remember when Judah's two sons died from their own wickedness? But Judah thinks Tamar is cursed, right? And so he distances himself. He says, I'm getting out of Tamar's way because she has this curse. Well, what does Ruth think? I mean, all that Naomi's family has experienced is sadness and sorrow, and it would be really reasonable for her to say, I'm going to get out of here because this family's cursed. But instead, she clings to Ruth. And she has these beautiful words that she says. And once I flip there, I'll let you know what they are. Do not press me to leave you or turn back from following you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. There I will be buried. And this is a picture of what the Old Testament calls chesed. It's this Hebrew word that's just so rich, and sometimes it's translated faithful love or steadfast love, but it's Yahweh's covenant, committed, faithful love. And so I want to teach you this word today. So it's chesed, and you really got to get down there. So let's say that together. 1, 2, 3, chesed. It really feels like faithful, steadfast love when you say it like that. But this is what Ruth is displaying here. She's reflecting this chesed, covenant, faithful love of God for Naomi. And she goes back to Naomi's hometown, which is Bethlehem, or a house of bread, where there's prosperity now. But still, even as they arrive, Naomi's depressed. So the people see Naomi come in town, and they say, oh, it's Naomi. And she says to them, call me no longer Naomi. Don't call me beautiful. Call me Mara, bitter. For the Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. She says, my name no longer fits. I'm no longer lovely and beautiful. I'm empty and bitter. And so Ruth not only stays with her, but she sees that Naomi doesn't really have prospects here either. And so she says, all right, here's what I'm going to do. Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain behind someone in whose sight I may find favor. She says, I'm going to provide for you. And she does. She goes to the fields, and the servants are harvesting. But in Israelite law, they had to leave the edges of the field unharvested for the poor and the alien, it says in the Old Testament. So for people who need it, and Ruth and Naomi need it. And so she goes and gleans this grain from the fields. And this is risky for her. Even though this was law, it's risky, one, because she's a woman. And she's out in the fields with a bunch of men, and that can be risky now and then. And because she's a foreigner. So even though it was supposed to be open, they weren't always welcome there. And so Naomi, or Ruth, is taking this great risk in providing for Naomi, but she does. And Boaz is one of the owners of the fields, and he takes notice of her, and he says, who's that? And one of his servants says, oh, that's Ruth, that's the daughter-in-law, the Moabite daughter-in-law of Naomi. And Boaz doesn't just take notice of her in the fields, but he's heard of her. He says, I've heard of her love for Naomi, her chesed, her faithfulness, her commitment. And so Boaz provides above and beyond. And you might say that sparks kind of fly, I think. He invites her over and says, you know, tell me about you. And he says, I'm going to give you extra grain, and I'm going to give the harvesters extra instruction just to make sure you go home overflowing for you and Naomi, because you have been faithful to her. And he says, don't go to any other fields, by the way. Stay here, because here you'll be safe. Here, I'll watch out for you. And so Ruth goes home just overflowing with grain. And she goes back to Naomi and tells her what happened. And now Naomi starts to perk up a little bit, and she has an idea. So Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, I need to seek some security for you so that it may be well with you. You know, you've cared for me. Now I need to care for you. Now here is our kinsman, Boaz. And that word kinsman is this special word, a technical legal word, where in order, if someone dies in a clan at that time, in order to keep the land in the clan, there were people who had rights to purchase it. And it's kind of an extended family kind of thing. And she says, Boaz is one of these guys who kind of has dibs on our land. And he could help us. He could provide for us. And so she comes up with this plan. Now here is our kinsman Boaz, with whose young women you've been working. See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Now wash and anoint yourself and put on your best clothes and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. And when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. And Ruth does this. And I'm just going to say that there are some different ways of interpreting all of this. And they're there in the text, in the Hebrew. So just like we have words that are suggestive, they might sound normal to someone who doesn't know our culture, but they're kind of suggestive to anyone who does know our culture. That's going on here, okay? So kind of the most conservative way of reading this is that Ruth goes to the threshing floor, and Boaz is full, and she goes and literally uncovers his feet so that as he sleeps and as the night gets colder and colder, he'll eventually wake up. Once everyone has gone away, he'll eventually wake up and he'll see Ruth lying there, and they'll be able to have a conversation in private. That's the most conservative and family-friendly way of reading this. Let's just put it that way. But regardless, there's a couple of things that are true. One, there is sexual tension here, okay? That's just reality. And two, this is risky. No matter what Ruth is doing, she does not want to be caught laying down on the threshing floor with Boaz. It's not good for either of them, really, if that happens. And so she's taking this great risk. And she actually goes beyond what Naomi says. And she basically proposes to Boaz. When he wakes up, he said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your cloak over your servant, for you are next of kin." She basically says, not just purchase back what belongs to Elimelech, but take me as well. And he says, "Sounds good." But there's this problem. There's this other guy, and we don't have his name. We'll call him the dude. There's this other dude who's kind of the next in line. He actually has dibs. And Boaz says, "We're going to do this the right way." So the next day, Boaz goes to the city gates, and this is where all the business is on. This is where everything is hashed out by the men in town. And the dude comes over, and Boaz says, "Hey, look, there's this business opportunity for you. You can buy back all of Elimelech's possessions." And the guy's like, "Great." And Boaz says, "Hold on though, there's one more thing. Like, there's this Ruth, this Moabite. And if you do that, basically everything will go to Elimelech's family, not just you." And he says, "Whoa, hold on. This is going to cut into my inheritance if I do this, and so I'll pass." And so Boaz ends up being able to provide for Naomi and Ruth. He marries Ruth. They have a child. So we might ask, like, how does, you might not be asking this, but I'm going to answer a question you weren't even asking. How does Jesus end up in Bethlehem? Well, here's what happens. The women of the neighborhood gave him a name, Obed, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi," and he became the father of Jesse, the father of David. And so this is how David's hometown is Bethlehem. And so all of David's descendants then, when the census is taken, like Joseph, have to go to Bethlehem to be counted. All right, so there's the story, and it's truly a beautiful story. And in this story, there are really two contrasts. One is the contrast between Orpah and Ruth, the two daughters-in-law. And again, Orpah doesn't do anything wrong. She does what's reasonable. But Ruth practices chesed. She goes above and beyond and shows this committed, faithful, steadfast love for Naomi. And then you have this contrast of the dude and Boaz. And the dude just does what is reasonable. Like, it just wasn't good for business to buy back this land for him. And so he doesn't. He passes. But Boaz practices chesed. He says, "I will provide no matter what the the financial cost might be to me. And so again, the dude and Orpah, and what they do is fine, but it's not chesed. And so what we have is Ruth the Moabite and Boaz the Israelite come together in this marriage of chesed, faithful, steadfast love that goes above and beyond. And it is this chesed that transforms the story of sorrow and bitterness into a story of redemption and joy. It hinges on Ruth's boldness for the sake of her family, for the sake of her mother-in-law, who's lost everything. And it hinges on Boaz's faithfulness, all within the context of a God who practices and reveals chesed love to his people. And so that's why Matthew picks up this story as he begins to introduce Jesus, to say that God is not this exclusive God, but we celebrate, God's people celebrate chesed wherever we find it and welcome it into our story. And so Matthew, by putting Ruth in this genealogy, it kind of has a dual effect. On one hand, we want to say, of course, Ruth is highlighted in the Jesus story because she embodies chesed, and Jesus is chesed incarnate, love incarnate, right? So of course, we would include this story. It's a perfect story to set up Jesus' ministry with. But on the other hand, it's shocking that this hated Moabite, who's ruining the purity of Israelite heritage, becomes the grandmother of David and the ancestor of Jesus, the Messiah, who is not just the King of the Jews, but is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, who welcomes in all who receive and commit to practicing the chesed love of God. And so the story of Ruth then is a foretaste to this radically welcoming and transforming chesed story of Jesus. And it says to us and to all who would come to Jesus that if you feel like you're separated from God for any reason, you've born in the wrong place or into the wrong class or the wrong race or the wrong name, or if you feel cursed, like God has dealt bitterly with you and you've lost everything and all you've received is bitterness and sorrow from God, well, we have this story here where this one stream of this unexpectedly bold chesed of an ordinary Moabite woman and this other stream of an Israelite man's faithful and compassionate care for a foreigner flow into the river of God's constantly redeeming chesed love, and the royal story of God's redemptive chesed goodness breaks through the dams of sorrow and loss, and the royal line and promise surges onward towards the one true and eternal King who will redeem all who are broken and bitter and bereaved, claiming them as God's own family, and multiplying his chesed love through his redeemed sons and daughters outward into the whole world. The story shows us that we are able to stand in the midst of death and danger and bitterness and loss with a joy that Karl Barth calls the defiant nevertheless. All this has been taken from me. Nevertheless, I will find joy in the God who takes what is lost and broken and dead and redeems and repairs and resurrects. Let's pray. Loving God, I pray that we would see that you are not just a God who does the ordinary provisions and gives us our needs, but that you are a God who goes above and beyond so that we can be filled to overflowing with your love. I pray that we would know, like Naomi, that you are a God who can take our bitterness and transform it into joy. And I pray that we would know that we, like Ruth, can join you in showing love for others that goes above and beyond. And in that, transform their sorrow into joy as well. Pray it all in the name of Jesus, the one who was crucified and raised again. Once and for all, transforming all death and sorrow into life and joy. Amen.